Vietnam stand became an important issue in 1968 when Greening battled for re-election. Since Greening was now 81, his age became perhaps an unspoken issue, but not according to Sandra Stringer.
First time I remember meeting Ernest Greening was, I believe it was in 1968 during the primary campaign. He was running against Mike Gravel, who later defeated him and went on to win the senatorial nomination and the senatorial race in that year. I was just beginning to become involved in politics, and I was really on the fringe of that campaign. I attended a few meetings mainly because it seemed to be an interesting thing to get into at the time. The main thing that struck me about Ernest Greening was that he was so old physically, and to see such an old man come up to address a group seemed to be just incredible that he was seeking the office until he began speaking. And once he began to speak, his age seemed to drop away from him. Listening to him, he didn't seem to be any particular age. He was a very convincing speaker.
Greening does not remember the 1968 campaign very fondly. In his autobiography, Greening claimed that Mike Gravel's commentary in a documentary movie showed Gravel in the United States Army as a member assigned to the French underground, although Gravel would have been only 15 when the war ended. Greening credited the film as a new campaigning technique. Ironically, Gravel's foreign policy campaign included the position that the United States definitely was not the aggressor in Vietnam, a position Gravel would later dramatically reverse. Greening claimed his supporters told him that Gravel had become Speaker of the House by promising more committee chairmanships than there were. Greening also charged, in his autobiography, that the president of a local airline was blackmailed by Gravel into a $10,000 contribution to the Gravel campaign. An era had ended for Alaska. Ernest Greening no longer represented the state. Although deprived of a forum in the United States Senate, Greening's voice continued in support of a number of his many battles. After 1968, Citizen Greening stepped up a campaign he had begun years ago as a newspaper man.
New ways to use our knowledge to help deal with the explosion in world population and the growing scarcity in world resources. Now that's what we're going to try and do. And my legislation isn't very radical or very drastic. It proposes to coordinate the scattered and ineffective methods by which this information is now being disseminated, partly through private agency, partly through municipal and local agencies, somewhat under the table by the federal agencies, and give it status and dignity and official sanction. And I propose to do that by creating two new offices with the rank of an assistant secretary, small cabinet rank, one in the Department of State, which would deal with this problem abroad in connection with our vast foreign aid program, and the other in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which would deal with the domestic program. And in addition to that, it calls for a White House conference on population control and population explosion in 1967. Those three things. Now, those are not very drastic proposals, but they are steps forward in that they aim to coordinate this information, place it in one center that is visible and knowledgeable, and where people can go to get the information, and where the responsibility will be lodged for disseminating what information there is. Well, that's what President Eisenhower says, and that's what most of our witnesses have said. This is a problem which threatens to overwhelm us unless we do something about it. Now, it's already been stated in our foreign aid program, it's been stated by people are being born so rapidly that no matter how much money we pour in and how much the people of those nations try to help themselves, they're overwhelmed. They can't build enough schools, they can't build enough houses, they can't supply enough medical care, they can't supply enough food in many cases to take care of these people. And in India, for instance, where we have hundreds of thousands dying of starvation, it is absolutely essential that we do something about this. Now, at home, we face a problem that is somewhat different in degree. And the only way to meet this situation is by education, to try to persuade the people that they must limit their families. And, of course, this has a great bearing on the war on poverty. president is very wisely conducting a campaign against poverty and a campaign against crime, and they're both related to the subject. When you get a lot of children born in a family, some of them illegitimate, without hope, without opportunity for education, unemployment, they naturally turn to crime. Through the ages, man's population increased very, very slowly. And then suddenly, in the last century, and particularly in this half century that we're in now, it has shot up like Mount Everest on the chart. And that is due to the great gains in modern science. We have eliminated a lot of diseases that formerly took a heavy toll of life. We have largely eliminated infant mortality. Someone called my attention earlier today that in the family of one great historian, of the six children, he was the only one that survived infancy. And we know that that's the case. We know that in the past generation, infant mortality was terrific. A child had a very poor chance of surviving his first 6 months or his first year of infancy, and all the other diseases that took toll. Now, in addition to that, we have all these new sciences, such as the science of immunology, a subscience of medicine, the subscience of preventive medicine, which precludes getting diseases before you catch them. People no longer die to any extent of such diseases that were formerly epidemic: cholera, bubonic plague, typhus, diphtheria, typhoid fever. People don't die of them anymore. We've eliminated them. Surgery has eliminated a lot of conditions that were formerly fatal. And new drugs, the antibiotics and penicillin, those things, stop infections. And that is the reason we have this great population explosion. So this is a new phenomenon of our time. And it's caused a great change in our thinking. And it's caused a great modification in the thinking of the Catholic Church, which is now examining this problem very seriously. As you know, the Pope has appointed a commission to study this and to see where the position of the Church, which in itself has been modified somewhat, because at an earlier time, they thought no method of birth control was desirable or moral. Now they take the position that the rhythm method is moral, but that is only one method. And to date, the position of the Church is that it frowns on other methods, artificial methods, chemical methods, the use of contraceptive mechanical devices. But that's likely to change within the last 24 hours. We've had a very important event. In that, we have learned that 81 Nobel Prize winners in a score of countries have petitioned His Holiness the Pope to change the Church's position on birth control. And if we started immediately in doing all the things I think we should do, we still could not catch up with the population explosion adequately. It is my hope that we will move soon enough to do something to diminish the accelerating increase in birth rates. As for other planets, the moon is uninhabitable, and it's going to be some time before we even get there. And the only other planet in our solar system which can possibly be even explored by man has so thin an atmosphere and other conditions so that it is not habitable. So that the idea of going to other planets is pretty fantastic. I think we'd have to confine our efforts to saving life on this planet. I think that if we necessarily want these horrible wars and mass starvation and savagery and a destruction of all the values that man has slowly built up through the ages into what we now call civilization, we'd better take the precautions that an intelligent application of birth control would produce. When there's a great scramble for the basic necessities of life and when these are not obtainable, people are not considerate of their neighbors. They don't obey the golden rule. It's a mad scramble for survival. And that means chaos, violence, local violence, crime, and on a larger scale, war between nations. And that even in those places where there has been, to date, a religious inhibition at the use of certain methods of birth control, there is a great demand. And in the hearings this morning, it was pointed out that the Gallup polls show that in this country, an overwhelming people of all religions, not merely Protestants and Jews who have no religion in division, but that the majority of the Catholics themselves want this information. And I think it is reasonable to assume that within a certain time, the Church will modify its position in response not only to changed conditions on earth, but in response to the great pressure and demand from its own Catholic laity. Countries change as conditions change. Sometimes they change more slowly than other times, But we've seen it again and again in our own country. We've seen great changes that come as circumstances require those changes and those adaptations. And just as in the early days of the Republic, when we were largely an agricultural people, and children were considered a great asset to the family because they would go out and help run the farms. Well, our population has now changed from an agricultural population to an urban population. And those children no longer have the usefulness as assistant breadwinners to the family that they had when we all lived on farms. And so that situation is changing. Certainly, I would violently object and resent, and I think the American people will resent, the intromission, the imposition by the government or by any exterior agency on the habits of an American family. It's up to them to decide. But then, when it is put up to them as a matter of intelligence, when they themselves know that a given family with a given income can properly educate two or three children, but not six, eight, or ten, that they will then use the necessary restraint and the necessary information, if it's available, to achieve that desirable balance.
In May of 1973, Greening commented on what he considered the most important state and national issues today.
We've got to realize that while conservation is not only desirable but essential, but the two-legged species needs a habitat too. And if he hasn't got an economy, he hasn't got a habitat. If the economy of Alaska became so precarious that people couldn't get a living there, they would move out. And we would drive the two-legged species outside of Alaska in the face of this allegation that we're injuring the four-legged species. Now, this is the pertinent issue all over the country today. And I think it's very pertinent and immediate in the case of the pipeline. Now, there isn't the slightest reason why this great oil resource and this gas resource, which discovered in Alaska, shouldn't be developed. Developed for the benefit of the people of Alaska and for the benefit of the people of the nation. We need oil. We need energy. We're facing a great energy crisis. Now, there are certain risks attendant to bring this out, and every possible precaution should be taken to prevent damage to the environment. I believe those precautions can be and should be taken, arrangements, so that if there should be a leak in the pipeline, which is entirely possible, that the flow would be immediately shut off, and if there had been a spill, it might spill over 1 acre or half an acre or maybe 2 or 3 acres up in the wilderness, which is very undesirable, but certainly not fatal, not disastrous, and that should be prevented. A greater danger, I think, comes at the end of the pipeline when the oil will be transferred to tankers, which have an unfortunate proclivity to colliding with each other or colliding with rocks, and that should be prevented by levying the heaviest kind of penalties on the tanker company and on the oil companies that permit those accidents to take place. If those penalties were so severe that they would inhibit these accidents, I think we'd be reasonably safe. Of course the oil should be brought out, but as I say, every possible precaution should be taken to prevent damage to the environment. So the great issue today is to reconcile conservation and development, to demonstrate, which I deeply believe, that they're not incompatible. We can have both. We should have conservation. We should protect the environment. But that doesn't mean that we've got to paralyze everything. Now, some of these extremists, and I will mention them, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, the Friends of the Earth, have done very noble work in their time. And they're continuing to do noble work. But they also have become extremists. Now, I can give you an illustration of that. At the present time, they're fighting the pulp industry in northern southeastern Alaska. We now have a pulp industry at Ketchikan and Sitka, and this industry would take the overripe timber, which is dying on the stump, which should be harvested, and which would actually be a good conservationist measure, provided the timber cutting is done in an intelligent and selective way. I'm not enthusiastic about clear cutting, which would sweep it all. I think there should be selective timber cutting.
But there's no reason why this project, this pulp mill, shouldn't be approved. But the conservationists, the extremist conservationists, are fighting it, and so far have blocked it, denying the people of southeastern Alaska and of all Alaska this economy, and preventing a really worthwhile project from materializing. And this is the attitude. This group of extremists block everything called conservation, called development. They're blocking the development of roads, which are frequently needed. But I hope out of this a saner balance will emerge, in which we realize that we need both. We need conservation and we need development, and we can have both. And each project should be studied from that standpoint. What are the benefits? What is the potential damage? What can we do to lessen the potential damage? After we've taken all possible precautions, isn't this project still worthwhile? And if it's found that it still is not worthwhile, then we shouldn't have it. But if on balance we find that it is, then we should go ahead. And that is an issue which is particularly focused on Alaska, not really by Alaskans, but by people all over the country. Or everybody in the country now wants to run Alaska. And I believe that we welcome the advice of people all over the country, but the final decision should be made by Alaskans, and I think they can make a sane and intelligent decision which will take care of this conflict and determine that we can safely and sanely have both conservation and development. I think the issue that the nation faces, crucial issue, is whether this great heritage of freedom handed to us nearly two centuries ago by a group of the wisest, most far-sighted, and most dedicated men in the history of mankind will endure, or whether it'll go down the drain and we will become a totalitarian country and a police state. Certainly the people of Alaska are and should be as much concerned with this overall problem as all Americans are. Our heritage was enshrined and dramatized, presented in two great documents, Declaration of Independence, which stated that people had a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and then the Constitution, which set up a system of checks and balances to prevent the people from oppression, and most importantly, in its First Amendment, guaranteed our basic liberties, which are the ones that are now jeopardized by actions of the executive. I needn't detail them because they're pretty well known now to the American public. For the first time in our history, an administration, a federal government, tried what is technically known as prior restraint. They wanted to prevent American newspapers from printing something they wanted printed, namely the Pentagon Papers. Well, what were the Pentagon Papers? The Pentagon Papers were a history of the war compiled inside of the Pentagon with buttressing of all the pertinent documents, which revealed that some of our trusted officials had not lived up to their responsibilities. While they were telling the public one thing in their press releases, in their white papers, they were doing just the opposite. And the American people had every right to know that. And yet the administration tried in every way possible to prevent that publication. It took them to court, and in the first instance to the district courts, and then the circuit courts in Boston, New York, and Washington. And in each case, the judges said, no, this is a violation of the First Amendment. And it was pointed out that never before in our history, never before, had any administration tried to prevent publication by prior action. Of course, the people have ample recourse. If a publication is libelous, they can sue and recover. But this was the first time it happened. But the administration persisted in its effort to try to prevent the publication and took it to the Supreme Court. And there, in a 6-3 decision, rendered by the late and great Justice Black, but concurred in by the others, pointed out that this would action, if approved by a majority of the court, would make the First Amendment a shambles. And it was rather striking that of the three dissenting judges, the three judges who would have made the First Amendment a shambles, were the two, at that time the only two, appointed by the President of the United States, which showed the direction in which this administration was going. And there were other such attempts. Persecution of newspaper men. For the first time in our history, newspaper men have been imprisoned, sentenced to jail, for refusing to reveal their sources. Never happened before in 173 years. If a newspaper man can't keep his sources confidential, he won't have those sources, and the public will be denied a lot of valuable information. They've gone beyond that, and this administration has not only attacked the freedom of the press, it's attacked the freedom of worship. I can give you a specific example. The Trinitarian Episcopal Church of Melrose, Massachusetts, held a peace meeting in one of its rooms. A lot of youngsters, high school and college boys, wanted to protest against the continuation of this war in Southeast Asia. And they asked this church for a room, which it gave them, and they had the meeting. And immediately thereafterwards, or shortly thereafterwards, the pastor of the church was visited by a representative of the Internal Revenue Service and told if he did that again, he would lose his tax-exempt status. Incredible. To attempt to suppress freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. Now, to say that peace is a subversive subject, and the church hasn't a right to interest itself in things outside of the realm of pure religion, peace and welfare and all the other things, was a precedent never before made in our history. And these are the things which should give us real concern and have created a crisis unprecedented in our history. I consider it the most serious crisis in our history. Because for the first time, we have in the White House a man who wants to curtail these liberties. Now, we had great crises before. Undoubtedly, the greatest crisis, a little over a century ago, came when, after a succession of weak presidents, the country was in danger of coming apart. The Buchanans and the Franklin Pierces and others who couldn't meet this emergency. But then the American people elected a great president who did what was necessary, even though it was necessary to go to war and to save the Union, which he did. And when it was clear that his measures, his steps, were saving the Union, he was able to report that victory by saying that it guaranteed that government of the people, by the people and for the people would not perish. But now, for the first time in our history, we have in the White House a man who believes in government by the president, government of the president, by the president, and for the president's friends and supporters. And that's what makes this such a serious crisis. And many people are worried about other things. High cost of living, naturally, it comes home to everybody. High cost of meat, the increase in crime. But they are not fully aware of how much more serious is this threat to the freedoms which made all these abuses possible when those freedoms were betrayed. If the people are not free to speak, not free to read, if they can't get the information they're entitled to, we're going to have corruption and deceit of the kind that is now being uncovered. I'm speaking on May 9th, 1973, which are the inevitable result of these other suppressions. If the people had known all they are beginning to know now, these things wouldn't have happened. And so this is something which concerns all of us. We can't have too much freedom. There are always plenty of safeguards against the abuse of freedom. What we need is freedom of every kind, and above all, freedom from fear, which is being inculcated by these repressive measures emanating from the White House. Unless we have good government, honest government, government that you can trust, all these secondary abuses will be aggravated. And as I quoted Abraham Lincoln, the essential thing is to preserve government of and by the people. And this is what we've got to have again. Confidence in our system of government, and a government which deserves that confidence. The obvious place where billions can be saved is in this militaristic folly that we're going into. You know, when I was a kid, our standing army consisted of, what would you believe, 25,000 men. We never saw a soldier in those days. Well, I grant you that conditions have changed, but the size of our military establishment is utterly fantastic and absurd. I don't know how many people realize it, but in addition to the $80 billion which goes to the defense budget, and it's going up all the time, we are spending other billions which are pretty well concealed because they're part of our foreign assistance program. We're today subsidizing not fewer than 50 foreign countries. Think of it. In the interest of mutual security, large sums of money, billions every year, go to such countries as Spain, Portugal, Greece, Brazil, dictatorships, which are supposedly used for something called mutual security. Well, most of these governments just take this money and entrench themselves, suppress the liberties of their people, and that's where the money goes. Do you feel any more secure when you find that several billion dollars have gone to Ethiopia, to Morocco, to Afghanistan, Pakistan? Well, that's where the money's going. 50 foreign countries, and it's perfectly fantastic. Now, that is why the cities have a perfect right to start yelling, although they may not know all this, and it's about time that we concentrate our efforts on the overdue and long-neglected domestic programs, which the cities are facing and unable to solve because they haven't got the money. Schools, police protection, health, environmental protection, all those things which we have so shockingly neglected while we squander these billions all over the world.
It is usually considered fitting to end a biographical exercise such as this one with a quote. I found such a quote that seems to typify Ernest Greening's beliefs and actions. This quote is from his autobiography. In the end, I came to realize that you may gain almost as much ground by making and losing a good fight for a good cause as if you had won it. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thank you very much for listening. The University of Alaska sent you this program.